Why are we talking about condition-based bundles? If the current healthcare reimbursement model is working, then why pursue alternative payment models? We must first acknowledge, as I think most people in this room do, otherwise you wouldn't be spending a sunny Friday afternoon here, that the current fee-for-service model is broken and is in need of repair. What's the problem? I think we're all familiar with these slides, but the United States currently spends more on healthcare as a percent of GDP than any other developed country in the world. What do we get for all that money? Of course, if you spend more, don't you get better stuff? Well, not always. Average life expectancy in the United States is on par with Cuba, despite spending 10 times more per capita on healthcare. What's the solution? Michael Porter and colleagues have proposed that one of the solutions to the current cost and outcome disparity is bundle payments. At the core of bundle payments is the alignment of the interests of the key stakeholders in healthcare, namely the patients, the payers, and the providers. What are the different types of bundles and where do they fit in the continuum of value-based care? As we move along the continuum of value-based care from your traditional fee-for-service to population capitation, we can see that we take on increasing risk and complexity. Bundles begin with retrospective bundles. I think most people in this room are probably familiar with these shared savings models as they were federally mandated in the CJR program and the optional but soon to be federally mandated BPCI program in the coming years. These are relatively low risk, but they do have a degree of complexity. We then move along into single capitation of the patient. And here we take on prospective procedure-based bundles. At Ortho Carolina, we've termed these true bundles. They're lower complexity as they're limited to a single, well-defined procedure over a predetermined period. But they do have increased financial risk that providers must assume. And at Ortho Carolina, we take reinsurance on these. To date, we've performed over 3,000 prospective commercial bundles, and we've generated significant savings for the payers and the patients while increasing providers' take-home by 300% of the traditional fee-for-service. So truly a win-win-win. What we're going to focus on today is the next step in this continuum, and that's prospective condition-based bundles. We talked about that a little bit earlier. These are both higher risk-reward, but they have increased complexity both to negotiate and to perform upon. In this talk, I'm going to focus on condition-based bundles. And what I'm going to argue is that although it's a large leap to go from the current fee-for-service payment model to a fully capitated population healthcare model, that these may just be the bridge for us to get there. So what is a condition-based bundle? It's a predetermined payment for the management of a condition, such as osteoarthritis of the hip and knee, which we're going to focus on this afternoon, for a predetermined period. And that's inclusive of all care rendered over that time frame. And this includes both the non-surgical and, when appropriate, the surgical care, both in the short and in the long term. How does this work? In a condition-based bundle, as the name would imply, the trigger is the condition and the diagnosis of osteoarthritis of hip or knee. This differs from procedure-based bundles in which the trigger is the actual surgery, the joint replacement. The bundle's for an extended period of time. Typically, these are anywhere from 6 to 12 months. And this differs from prospective procedure-based bundles that can be as short as same day and last up to 90 days. Well, why do they exist? Why should we look at condition-based bundles? Condition-based bundles address the opportunities both upstream and downstream from surgery that procedure-based bundles currently do not. And this allows for greater opportunities for providers to create, deliver, and capture value. So how is value created? It's a little more complex than in a procedure-based bundle. First, you've got to start with a predetermined negotiated payment for that condition over a period of time. And then we have to account for the cost of all the non-surgical care that'll be rendered. We also have to account for the cost of the surgical care, and we have to account for what percent of patients within a population are going to have surgery. As we'll talk about later, this may be changing. I believe that orthopedic surgeons have a fundamental decision to make, as I alluded to earlier. Do we want to be relegated to technicians, only called upon to perform procedures when deemed appropriate by primary care doctors or other folks that are upstream from us? Or do we want to be entrepreneurs, and do we want to own the full continuum of risk, both upstream and downstream? I believe that there's no one better suited to do this than musculoskeletal providers. So what are these opportunities to create value? So condition-based bundles offer great opportunities for value creation, both upstream and downstream. We start with diagnostic services. Think about plain film x-rays as opposed to an MRI. I don't know how many times I'm a spine surgeon, not a hip and knee surgeon. I get patients sent to my office that have had an MRI of their back for back pain, and no one ever bothered to simply just start by getting a plain x-ray. We then move on to other non-surgical management, such as physical therapy, injections, and DME, and the appropriate use of these. And then there's that small matter of surgery itself. Like a procedure-based bundle, providers are awarded for performing higher quality procedures at a lower cost. However, unlike procedure-based bundles, where the incentive is still to perform surgery, in a condition-based bundle, providers are incentivized not to perform what I'll term avoidable surgery. And it's been estimated that up to a third of total joint arthroplasties that are performed in the United States are for inappropriate indications. Finally, there's the opportunity to create value downstream through long-term maintenance of care beyond the period of a procedure-based bundle. What does this actually look like in practice? Well, we've got to start with the trigger. What triggers an osteoarthritis bundle to occur? A potential trigger for osteoarthritis is the episode of care is a professional claim, either an E&M code, a physical therapy code. It has to have the primary diagnosis of osteoarthritis of the hip or knee. It then has to be confirmed by a second primary diagnosis in a predetermined period of time. So it's not good enough if the patient came in once and got diagnosed. They have to come back and get diagnosed a second time. This diagnosis then has to be confirmed with an x-ray, some kind of imaging that shows that, in fact, this is the diagnosis. There's the issue of having multiple claims. I think most of us take care of patients realize that they don't always just have osteoarthritis of the hip. They might have in their knee and in their back. So the way these condition-based bundles work, if a patient is already in a condition-based bundle for osteoarthritis of the knee and presents during that bundle with knee pain and gets diagnosed with osteoarthritis of a different joint, that can't then trigger a new condition-based bundle because you can only have one bundle occurring at a time. Then there's a matter of attribution. Who gets attributed the bundle? Is it the primary care provider? Is it the orthopedic surgeon? Is it somebody else that's caring for that patient? Typically, attribution is the provider that's deemed in the best position to influence the quality and the cost for the patient during an episode. This is based upon which provider delivers most of the care and or performs a surgery if it's deemed appropriate. Care then proceeds down through our normal conservative and, if appropriate, operative treatment. What I'd like to look at next is how does that treatment differ between our traditional fee-for-service, procedure-based bundles, which many of you are probably familiar with, and condition-based bundles. I want to look at a few examples. Let's take physical therapy to start with. So in a fee-for-service model, why not do physical therapy? Especially as an orthopedic practice, if you own your own physical therapy, you want to keep those folks busy. And not to be facetious, but you know, we own the physical therapy. It is an ancillary service. On the other side, there's the insurance companies. Oftentimes, we have patients that have end-stage disease, and we know they're not going to benefit from physical therapy, yet the insurance companies make this a hurdle that we have to jump through prior to performing the surgery. Procedure-based bundles, the alignment's still the same because the physical therapy occurs prior to the bundle, so there's no incentive to avoid the cost of physical therapy. Condition-based bundles change all this. Now we're responsible for the care before and afterwards. Typically, there isn't utilization review because we're on the hook financially. We're owning that risk. So a patient comes in and you know that they have end-stage osteoarthritis and physical therapy is not going to benefit them, then you can move straight to surgery. There's limited evidence that shows that supervised exercise prior to a total joint changes their pain or physical function after surgery. So we own the risk, we can make the decision, we can move forward. How about the concept of disease prevention? As an orthopedic surgeon, that's not really a concept I'm all that familiar with. After all, we get paid to do procedures, right? Well, no different than procedure-based bundles. We're still being incentivized to perform procedures. So why would we want to prevent progression of disease? Condition-based bundles absolutely changes this and realigns the interest. Now, we want to avoid surgery when it's avoidable. And we want to move straight to surgery when we know that's what the patient needs and there's no point wasting time ahead of time beforehand or resources on physical therapy. How about optimizing a patient prior to surgery? Obviously, we all want our patients to do the best, and if we optimize them, we do think they'll have better outcomes. But in a fee-for-service world, I hate to say it, we're incentivized to keep operating. So why would we want anything to get in the way of that? Procedure-based bundles do change this, because now we're on the hook for the cost of complications, assuming these are bundles that don't last a day, assuming these are procedure-based bundles that last longer than the day of surgery. And then condition-based bundles completely change this, because now you're on the hook not just for the short term, but for the long term. So you really got to think long and hard about optimizing your patient before you operate on them because you're going to own those complications. And there's good evidence that shows that obese patients don't do as well and that folks with diabetes have a higher risk of having a postoperative complication. What about post-acute care? I think anybody that participated in the BPCI program saw how this works. In the fee-for-service world, post-acute care was not something I thought about. Home health, SNF, inpatient rehab, I didn't know what that was. I just wanted to get the patient out of the hospital so I didn't have to round on them. And heck, if they went to a SNF, I didn't have to worry about them because someone else is going to care for them. I love those things. Procedure-based bundles changed all that, right? Now I'm on the hook for 90 days. And now we started to do a real look and say, does home health make a difference? Do patients need SNF and inpatient rehab? I think most of you that participate in BPCI saw that most of our patients don't need any of this stuff. Talking to my hip and knee colleagues, most of those patients don't get any kind of post-operative physical therapy. They get instructions and exercises, they do it on their own. Condition-based bundles I don't think will change this. I don't think there's a long-term benefit to sending a patient to an inpatient rehab or a SNF, so I think, again, condition-based bundles continue this alignment. So if condition-based bundles are so great and that's what we should be doing, what are the challenges? Because obviously there's always issues or anything. As I raised before, they're not as straightforward as procedure-based bundles. In fact, they're a lot more complex. Let's start with the trigger. So the trigger for an osteoarthritis bundle of hip and knee, as we said, was a diagnosis of osteoarthritis of hip or knee. So we're in negotiations with one of the large payers, and they did an analysis for us, and they came back and they said, well, unfortunately, we're going to have to do a condition-based bundle on osteoarthritis of the hip and knee and hip and knee pain. And I said, why? And they said, well, there's just not enough opportunity. I said, what do you mean there's not enough opportunity? We're a huge practice. We treat a plethora of patients that have OA hip and knee. We do thousands of joint replacements per year. How can there not be an opportunity? So I asked them, I said, can you go back and take a look at all the hip and knee replacements we performed on the patients in your insurance and let me know what the diagnosis was? 90%. 90% of the time, my partners diagnosed them with hip and knee pain and did not put a specific diagnosis of osteoarthritis of the hip and knee. I think anybody in this room can imagine trying to take on a condition-based bundle for hip and knee pain is a totally different animal than doing it for osteoarthritis of the hip and knee. So coding properly matters. How about attribution? So I mentioned earlier that the attribution goes typically to the provider that generates the most cost in the end. Well, we know if we do surgery, automatically we're going to generate the most cost. I mean, you'd have to do a lot of preoperative conservative care to charge more money than the surgery. So you have to think about it. Do you want surgical patients in your bundle, even if you're involved in their preoperative non-surgical care? Do you want to be financially liable for upstream care if you weren't responsible for it? Do you simply want to exclude these patients from a condition-based bundle and instead just put them into a procedure-based bundle so you don't have to be on the hook for it? I think providers have to be very careful when they enter into these condition-based bundles and when they're negotiating with insurers about the risk that they're going to take on. Because while these patients will increase the number of eligible patients, it decreases the surgeon's ability to impact the non-surgical spend. And I think there's a lot that we can help impact upstream. This then flows into the whole concept of pricing methodology. Typically, with a condition-based bundle, it's a blended rate of both the non-operative and operative patients. So they don't break it out into a condition-based bundle for operative patients and a condition-based bundle for non-operative patients. That would be a procedure-based bundle. We're on the hook for all of it. Surgical, non-surgical, whether we operate, we don't operate. Typically, they do this based upon historical spend. They use trend lines, and they look at inflation. And so again, you have to think about including or excluding these surgery-only patients. And if you're going to include them, then simply just work this into your negotiation of the price, because that's the risk that you're going to take on. Risk adjustment methodology is really important, and I think it got really important over the last 2 years with COVID-19. As we said, the pricing methodology is based upon historical trends. So we start to have to ask ourselves, how has COVID affected historical utilization patterns? Are we now accepting risk on patients that have increased comorbidities than historical? Were patients unwilling or unable to undergo elective care? How did that change the number of joints that are being performed historically versus what's going to be performed moving forward? You need to take all this into account. And finally, there's that small issue of provider behavior. So if you want to perform in a condition-based bundle, you got to be able to change physician behavior. And I think we talked about this a little bit earlier. I would submit that that may be the greatest challenge of all in condition-based bundles, is getting providers to change their behavior. But a famous manager of people, the former CEO of GE, the late Jack Welch, once said that the secret to managing people was to reward the behavior you want to see. Surgeons are smart people. They'll figure it out. If we change the reward and the incentive structure, the behavior will change. So in the end, are condition-based bundles better? I argued before that I do think they're here to stay. I certainly hope they are. The broader focus on condition-based bundles allows us providers to have a larger impact on the continuum of care and thus greater opportunity for value creation. The upfront management for the payment of a condition creates an annuity. We get paid even when no direct care is being delivered. So think of those first few months of COVID when elective healthcare in the world ground to a halt. I certainly know in my practice, it would have been nice if there were dollars still coming in the door for managing these patients appropriately, non-operatively. With a few exceptions, our current delivery healthcare system is fragmented and it's poorly coordinated. And I think everybody in this room knows that siloed care results in significant waste and potential harm to our patients through duplicative tests, procedures, and delays in cares. Integrated practice units, which have been championed by Kevin Bozick and others, are rewarded in condition-based bundles. They actually incentivize this coordination. And finally, condition-based bundles can help specialists maintain a relevance in the transforming healthcare landscape. I think we as specialists are at risk of being marginalized by both primary care providers and payers. As specialists, we have to demonstrate our value proposition in the healthcare market. And I think fortunately we do have a lot of value to add, and I think payers are interested in working with us. So what's our experience been with at Ortho Carolina? As I said, we're currently negotiating, developing bundles depending on the payer we're working with. Talked about the need for accurate diagnosis. I think when you take on a bundle, you have to be very careful. You stipulate what's going to be included. You want to remove things such as tumor and trauma, things that are very difficult to manage in a condition. And finally, I'd say this isn't easy. There's been a lot of talk about condition-based bundles, but so far, I'd submit to you, except for some small pockets, probably represented by folks in the room, there's been little action. So finally, are condition-based bundles the future? Well, to quote the great philosopher Yogi Berra, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. But here it goes. Healthcare is changing. The lifespan of procedure-based bundles is limited. BPCI has already shown us that this can be a race to the bottom. Population health is the future, I believe. And condition-based bundles, while not simple, may be the bridge to the future for specialty care. Musculoskeletal providers need to be at the table. We need to be providing solutions and not roadblocks. If we don't capture this opportunity, then we risk missing the boat and being left behind like these two. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Neil. I'm going to ask Andrew Spitzer to come up. Dr. Spitzer is a professor of orthopedic surgery. He's the clinical director of the orthopedic service and the co-director of the joint replacement program at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. Andrew is a thought leader in this space, lectures widely, and sits on multiple editorial boards. Andy?
Thank you, Zev. Good afternoon, everybody. Hopefully you're coming out of your food coma. It really is a privilege to be here to speak, especially with this really exemplary faculty. And I'd like to share with you some thoughts about one of my passions, which is knee osteoarthritis, non-operative treatment options. These are my disclosures. I consult for Pacira and DePue, and a shout out to my home institution, Cedars-Sinai, number one in LA in orthopedics, number one in California, number three in the nation. So what are we going to talk about this afternoon in this talk? Demographics of osteoarthritis, an approach to management, assessing value to the best that I as a clinician can try and do that, and some highlights regarding triamcinolone acetonide extended release and cryoneurolysis as options that I think have value, and a little bit about what the potential future shows. So knee osteoarthritis in the U.S. is a big problem. 14 million patients, we've already heard. 57% of those are less than age 65. Median age of diagnosis is 55. That means a lot of people are diagnosed before 55 and many after as well. Lifetime risk, 45%. Women are a little more prevalent than men. It contributes to multiple medical comorbidities, including all-cause mortality, and we spend a lot of money on it. 2013 dollars, $304 billion. That was 1% of the GDP. And according to current guidelines, 54% of patients will have total knee replacements. Maybe a third of those are not warranted, but as we heard in the last talk, but the fact is current guidelines would suggest that maybe they are. Well, we know that osteoarthritis has shifted in recent years and is being diagnosed earlier. So in the 45 to 64 range, as opposed to 20 years ago, when it was much more in the older cohorts. We also know that people are living longer. So a person who's 65 today has about a 60% chance of getting to the age of 80, about a 30% chance of getting to the age of 90. So what's the implications of that? In the 90s, if you were diagnosed with osteoarthritis of the knee, you maybe lived 3, 5, maybe 10 years with that disease. Now, if you're diagnosed at, say, age 56, you may be living 25 to 30 years with that disease. Well, that really defines a chronic disease, and we have to look at osteoarthritis of the knee as that patient being a patient of ours for life. We have to look at this as a longitudinal, preemptive approach, and with a combination of evaluation, education, and engagement, we want to smooth the peaks of the episode. We want to improve patient satisfaction, and at the end of the day, as you see sort of in the timeline of the aging patient on the left, we want to provide the right treatment for the right patient at the right time. So what is this disease of osteoarthritis? Steve Abramson, who is the chair of the Department of Rheumatology at NYU, I think succinctly explained it. Osteoarthritis is age-dependent. We can't really do anything about that. It's mechanically driven, but biochemically mediated. So where can we intervene and how? Well, typically, the treatment of osteoarthritis has been described as a pyramid. We all know this. We start at the bottom with milder disease, and we intervene with sort of non-invasive, non-pharmacologic modalities, patient education, PTOT, weight reduction, exercise-assisted devices. As the disease worsens, we start to use over-the-counter medications, perhaps prescription strength, intra-articular injections, and of course, as a surgeon, we sit at the top of the pyramid, or at least that's what we would like to believe. And that's sort of the way we treat this disease. But there are limitations at every point in the pyramid. At the very top, it's costly, there are complications, imperfect outcomes. Question is every patient eligible or should they be eligible? At the bottom, there's compliance, engagement issues, and all along the path, there's whether or not it's effective and whether what the adverse event profiles are. So how do we choose amongst all of the things that are available? Well, the AAOS has perhaps helped us, perhaps not, but management of osteoarthritis of the knee, non-arthroplasty, evidence-based clinical practice guidelines were published just about a year ago. And if you sort them by guideline, I don't expect you to be able to read this chart, but it's just a mishmash of a bunch of things. And they're variable, different. They come in different order. They come in different strengths, different recommendations. So how do we get some clarity on this? Well, if we begin to sort by recommendation and we color code them, we see at least now we have the yeses in green, the maybes in yellow, and the noes in red. So if we forget about the bottom third of the chart, the ones we shouldn't do, and now we sort by strength, perhaps we begin to gain some clarity. So we have the yeses in green with strong recommendation, the yeses and maybes in blue with moderate recommendation, and then the maybes with limited recommendation or limited strength of data in the yellows. But still, we're kind of left with how do we choose? And if we're left with that, what ends up happening? So this was a paper that was presented at the Academy by Poster just a short period of time ago. It was from New England Baptist. And it's a rehash of some of the other data that's been published in the literature already. The cost of non-surgical procedures for OA knee in the 1 year prior to total knee arthroplasty. So this was an observational study, 24,000 patients. And what did they do? They looked at patients who had total knee in 2 years, and then they looked at what the overall costs of care were, sort of as an orthopedic bundle or condition-based bundle. And the average cost per patient in the year before total knee replacement was $1,355 plus or minus $2,087. Let's multiply that by the 24,000, we get $33 million. And if we multiply it by over 600,000, which are the number of patients that we take care of with total knees every year, we're talking about $2.4 billion spent on the management in the 1 year prior to total knee arthroplasty when the end game is already really written. We can't sustain that. So the question is, how do we provide this kind of care in a value-based manner? We've seen this equation multiple times. So I'm not an economist. I'm not a health resource person. So I'm going to forget about cost. And I'm going to tell you, and a lot of people out there probably argue with me, that cost is probably not the most important thing. Quality is. That's the top line, and that correlates directly with value. Unfortunately, I don't think anybody really knows what quality is. But here's how I would, in fact, define that in my clinical practice on a day-to-day basis when I'm looking patients in the eye. Safety, efficacy, durability, and the ability to repeat the treatment or continue the treatments. All of that is surrounding a central focus of the patient and the patient engagement and involvement and interest in their disease and interest in getting better. So if we look at that patient engagement, what does that consist of? Well, certainly compliance with the care that we provide with them, the recommendations we make, the interest in their outcomes, the partnership that we have with them as physicians, and the time and effort that they're willing to invest in a positive outcome. So I like to call that the determinants of the likelihood of a successful outcome. My friend, my mentor, my boss, who's sitting in the audience, Mark Veris, likes to call this the cost of failure. So you have a patient who has a total knee, they don't do their rehab, they end up stiff, they don't do well. That's a cost to all of us of a failed intervention. Or as Jim McKay used to say in Sunday nights in my house every week on Sunday nights, ABC Wide Wide World of Sports, the thrill of victory in some cases, or what we all experience on some rare days as surgeons, the agony of defeat. Well, Kevin Bozek has recently published this article, which puts it in modern terms, Value-Based Healthcare, Five Strategies to Save Patients, Physicians, and Dollars. And at the center of the circle, around which all the concentric circles live, is this understanding of a shared health need of the patient. So quotes from his article, understanding and prioritizing patient preferences and goals is our foundational principle, and to improve care coordination for patients and clinicians, clinics must first define in granular detail their patients' needs. The patient's at the center. So if we put all of this together and we try and look at what quality is from a slightly different metric, this impact effort curve, if you will, we see on the x-axis patient engagement, their investment in the process, their desire to get better. On the left, low engagement, on the right, high engagement. And we also see on the y-axis impact, the impact of the intervention that we want to have. So if you look at the top right, total knee arthroplasty is arguably very effective, but it requires real patient partnership, as we said before, in order to really succeed. On the lower right quadrant, we see things that still require patient investment. They got to do their exercise. They got to take their medicines. They got to show up. But some of those things may not be all that helpful. Where we want to live is in the upper left quadrant. And this is a new way, as far as I know, of looking at this, where we want patients to be able to show up, to show some interest. But if they do that, then the interventions that we provide will make them better. And that's what we would like to be able to offer our patients. And if you look at all of the different things that the Academy has recommended, there are two things that bubble up into that quadrant, quite frankly. That's intra-articular steroids and denervation therapy. Now, we can argue about the value of that, but I'm going to talk a little bit in detail about two particular treatment options that I think potentially have a way forward in the future to really change the game here, to change the natural course of our treatment process and the bundle, if you will, of the management of osteoarthritis of the knee. So injections first, 14 million patients with OA, 5.2 million patients treated with injections, 4.2 with steroid, 1 million with HAs, and if you consider repeat dosing, then 7.5 million injections given every year. That's a lot of injections. But there's this unmet need, because the holy grail is really early onset of action and sustained duration of action. Usually those things don't go together. Usually a standard steroid is like a fire extinguisher. It's one and done. You give the injection, but it's gone in a few weeks and it doesn't really last. HAs, long runway to take effect, but then they last for a little bit longer, maybe, if they last. And we'd like to base all of this decision on good data, on a foundation of efficacy. So let me introduce to you something that I think is innovative. This is TAER, extended-release triamcinolone, or Zilretta. On the left, you see an electron scanning micrograph of a microsphere of polylactococlycolic acid. This is the same material as Vicryl. When that's exposed to an aqueous environment, the triamcinolone crystals inside begin to slowly elute, and the microsphere is degraded to CO2 and water and eliminated by the lungs and the kidney. So what happens when you put this into a joint? Well, we see, first of all, sustained intra-articular concentrations of the drug itself, out to 12 weeks. You can measure levels, as opposed to a standard steroid, which is probably gone from between 4 and 6 weeks. In addition, it doesn't leak out, it really doesn't leak out to any considerable degree into the plasma circulation. 18 times lower plasma circulation, as opposed to standard steroid. And in terms of the pharmacodynamics, the systemic impact of what's in the system, it's very low. This is diabetes. Diabetic patients, type 2, you can see for the first 3 days before injection, their diabetes is well controlled. They get an injection, standard steroid, sends them pretty much through the roof in terms of their glucose control for the first three days or so. Whereas with Zilretta, just a few little peaks above the 180 line, but for the most part below in reasonable glucose control. So really low pharmacodynamic impact systemically. Let's take a look at the study that really proved the point of all of this. So this was a three-arm study, TAER versus saline versus standard steroid. And the primary endpoint that was looked at over the course of 12 to 24 weeks was average daily pain intensity from baseline when compared to placebo. And there were a number of simultaneous, real-time, secondary outcomes that were looked at as well. Western Ontario McMaster Osteoarthritis Index, the KOOS quality of life, use of rescue medications, and a number of others. So what was shown? Well, the first thing, the primary endpoint, significant substantial reduction, 50% reduction in baseline pain over 12 weeks and extending to 16 weeks. So that was very significant, p-value less than 0.0001. What about onset of action? This is average daily pain intensity at baseline. The patients were in the pretty much warm, hot numbers. By 1 week, 50% of patients had no or mild pain, and by 12 weeks, we're seeing that still 70% of patients have no or mild pain. So we're starting to chip away at really what this unmet need is in terms of providing early onset of action and sustained duration of action. Now we add in standard steroid, the story gets a little bit more complicated. There's still a numeric but not a statistical difference between ZILRETTA and standard steroid, but we know that average daily pain intensity is not a particularly sensitive measure. It doesn't take into consideration, for instance, comorbidities or other sources of pain, in particular, the other knee or the other joints. So Mike Langworthy actually helped us to understand this and stratify this with unilateral knee osteoarthritis, where he reanalyzed post hoc the data, and what he found was is that if you just take a look at unilateral knees, then in fact, the ZILRETTA does separate from standard steroid based on average daily pain intensity. And this is a little bit more complex, but the inclusion criteria was average daily pain intensity from 5 to 9. But there were a group of those patients that did not have high scores on WOMAC-A or pain before entrance into the study. So if you add actually concordance of the ADP and the WOMAC, so patients who scored with pain on both scales, again, you see separation of the ZILRETTA from triamcinolone on ADP. Why does WOMAC add that? Because it's a disease and joint-specific measure that is helpful in terms of differentiating specific pain related to the knee itself. We see this in the secondary outcomes as well. You can see on the top right two slides and then the bottom three that WOMAC A, pain, WOMAC B, stiffness, WOMAC C, physical function, all statistically improved over standard steroid and placebo, whose quality of life improves and rescue medications diminish. So that led the AAOS guidelines to call out ZILRETTA, T-A-E-R. Our analysis demonstrated that extended release IA steroids can be used over immediate release to improve patient outcomes. So we're starting to move towards that upper left-hand quadrant, as we'll see again in a moment. It can also be safely repeated. This was a study that I was involved in, looking at repeat administration in an open-label manner. 208 patients received the first injection. After 3 months, they were offered another injection. 95% had clinical benefit. 92% opted for a second injection. Pretty good endorsement of their patient experience relative to this drug. About 16 weeks was the median time to reinjection, but pretty even distribution between week 12 and 24. Let's move on to the other topic very briefly, cryoneurolysis. Cryotherapy is a local or general use of low temperatures in medical therapy. The application of cold to nerve tissue blocks conduction of pain, much like a local anesthetic, and we call this cryoneurolysis. So just a quick primer on nerve anatomy. Endoneurium is the layer of connective tissue around an individual axon, perineurium around a group of axons or the fascicle, and epineurium around the nerve itself. Those are the conduits through which the nerves run. So what happens with neurolytic agents? On the far left-hand side, you can see that cold therapy, very cold therapy, actually permanently damages or destroys the nerves. On the opposite end of the spectrum, you get the same thing with radiofrequency ablation if you apply it without cooling it. That's what cooled RFA is. You have to cool that heat, otherwise it damages not only the tissues but the nerve potentially in an irreversible manner as well. Finally, in the middle, cryoneurolysis occurs at a specific temperature, at negative 88 degrees centigrade, which I'll explain in a second. And what does that do? It results in a very consistent and temporary improvement in or destruction of the nerve, I should say. So what happens here? You apply this cold zone around the nerves, and this encompasses the nerve and results in degeneration of the axon and myelin sheath, but it preserves the conduit, the epineurium, the perineurium, and the endoneurium. So you have an accident at the entrance of the Lincoln Tunnel, the tunnel's empty, right? Except as soon as they clear the accident, the cars return to the tunnel. So the conduit is still there, and once the injury occurs, regeneration begins. And so this is shown diagrammatically here. On the left, you see the injury itself by the cryoneurolysis. You see the degeneration occur. The conduits are still there. The nerve regenerates 1 millimeter a day and eventually ends up with reinnervation of the tissue. This is how it's applied. It's a product called Iovera, and this is a handheld device that applies this directly subcutaneously to the nerves themselves. And this is how it works, and this is why negative 88 degrees centigrade is exactly what happens every time, time one and time forever, because the liquid nitrogen is used to create this cold zone, and the liquid nitrogen freezes at negative 88 degrees centigrade. So it forms this cold zone, and diagrammatically what you can see here actually not diagrammatically, actually demonstrating the percutaneous nature of it. The little orange dots are diagrammatic of nerves, and you can see in the middle panel there that there's this little ice that forms around the nerves themselves and then dissipates, and that's what does the temporary damage. And how is this, what's the philosophy here, what's the approach, is really targeting the distribution of the sensory nerves that cause pain around the knee, anterofemoral cutaneous nerve, lateral femoral cutaneous nerve, and infrapatellar branch of the saphenous nerve. So this can be applied percutaneously using anatomic landmarks, or it can be applied using ultrasound with deeper needles. And what does the data show on this? So a similar type of study, multi-center prospective, sham-controlled, double-blind, N equals 180, there were 180 patients randomized 2-to-1, and the endpoints were looked at 30, 60, 90, and 120 days, primary being the change in WOMAC pain to day 30. But we looked at 30, 60, 90 days, as I said, and you can see a statistically significant improvement in baseline pain at each of those time points with this individual treatment. So again, something that relies really on physiology and anatomy and doesn't really depend on anything other than the patient showing up for the treatment. So just to review, osteoarthritis is a longitudinal chronic disease. That patient is a patient for life, and we want to try and really provide that patient with the right treatment for the right at the right time for his particular or her particular needs. We want to do that in a value-based manner, and I would argue that improving the quality and choosing implementation of options that really live in that upper left quadrant in order to improve quality is really going to help us to achieve these goals. And at the center of this, remember, is the patient, what the patient needs, what the patient wants. And we try and individualize to that patient. And again, as I just mentioned, choosing from hopefully what will populate with future treatments, that upper left-hand quadrant in particular. And so if we look at where we are currently with the patient journey of osteoarthritis, maybe after 10 years they get their first injection, and then slowly over time patients deteriorate, maybe they get their total knee replacement at 20 years after first having pain, where could we go? Maybe we could elevate that curve. We can push things out a bit. We could kick the can down the road, hopefully with less of a sore knee, and ultimately do that knee replacement later and avoid the downstream consequences of a potential revision late in life. So hopefully that's where we're going in the future, and I really appreciate your attention. Thanks so much.
Great. Our next speaker is Dr. Vino Dasa. Vinny is the Vice Chair of Academic Affairs at the Department of Orthopedics at LSU. He also has an endowed chair in research. Anyone who follows social media has heard about him, have heard or has read something he has wrote. He has a new platform called Doc Social, which is pretty phenomenal. And he also has a startup that I'm not allowed to talk about. But he's now going to talk about perioperative approaches for the management of pain.
LinkedIn, if anyone's interested, feel free and connect with me. Happy to talk. So a lot of the topics, a lot of the things I'm going to talk about, either whether it's now or later, I'll post about, especially patient videos and things like that, compliant. And so happy to engage either digitally or in person. So today we're going to talk about the management of knee OA in the context of perioperative pain management. But this is somewhat going to overlap a little bit with Dr. Spitzer, because the management of knee OA obviously doesn't change necessarily just because you're about to have surgery. So we're going to go over kind of the management of knee OA and go through some of the common treatment options that are out there. So here are my disclosures that all the lawyers make us put up for you guys. So the reason I have a job, and probably most everyone in this room exists, is for these two reasons at the top when it comes to arthritis, is cartilage is avascular and aneural, right? So there's no blood flow in cartilage, so it can't heal, and there are no nerve endings, so we can't feel it. So the reason I have a job is because all that cartilage wears away, the patient then comes to me for a knee replacement, hence I can do surgery. So if we knew about what was going on much earlier in the disease process, we probably would not be doing knee replacements to the extent that we're doing, but that's not how Mother Nature works. And so because of that, how do we manage knee OA over time? So you saw from Dr. Spitzer, the Academy came out with the CPG guidelines this past fall. The 2013 guidelines only had 15 treatment options. This one has nearly 30. So when you talk about condition-based bundles and you see where the system is heading, you're starting to see that we're looking at the management of OA much more holistically than we did even 5 or 10 years ago. So you saw the pyramid earlier, and we have these new innovations, these new treatments that are coming down the pike, and we're still trying to figure out where they fit. Some of them fit along the entire continuum, some fit earlier, some fit later. So some of the things that are coming down are some of the evolving research that's out there. There's a lot of interest in knee braces and knee sleeves. So here are a couple knee braces. This one that fits on the thigh for management of knee OA really helps with patellofemoral arthritis or patellofemoral pain. So these are all research studies that have shown that some of these braces help. Now, the unloader brace that many of you may have heard about is not necessarily as useful. A lot of the sports guys will use it. But if you look at how many patients actually wear these braces, after 2 years, about 80% of them are in the closet. So this is something right off the presses. So we presented this paper last year looking at neuromuscular electrical stimulation. And then this paper just got published last week in Arthroplasty Today. So there's a lot of interest in NMES. And so this is some evolving data showing if you stimulate using a specific radio pulse to the quadriceps that you can eliminate or reduce pain. And this some of this technology was recently FDA approved as well for the management of knee OA. So obviously, a lot of us are into and use vitamins and nutritional supplements. So you can see some of the opportunities here for managing our patients and their knee OA, antioxidants, glucosamine, chondroitin. You can see the different vitamins here. Again, just like with most of you, some of them have good relief, some of them don't. You know how much of this is placebo effect, but some of these may work. And these are potential opportunities for your patients to manage their pain. Now, this is growing quite significantly right now, kind of as we speak, this concept of food as medicine. You're starting to see a lot of data come out about nutritional supplements and trying to suppress or manage inflammation based on your diet. And so these are supplements that are coming out almost by the day. And so these are new opportunities, I think, potentially to intervene with our patients, especially in the perioperative timeframe. You're starting to see a lot of places starting to look at some of this food of medicine concept going into surgery and then also coming out of surgery to help manage their symptoms, not only before, but also hopefully enhance their outcomes with surgery. So obviously, these are the tried and true treatments that we've been using for quite some time, NSAIDs and then narcotics. Obviously, you have to worry about the GI and cardiovascular side effects. If you use glucosamine chondroitin, this is typically how you should use it, 1,200 and 1,500 milligrams of glucosamine and chondroitin. Again, this data is somewhat controversial, but another opportunity to intervene if your patients want some element of management of their knee OA. When we look at NSAIDs, there's a challenge. Obviously, a lot of us are starting to pull back from using NSAIDs, but I get asked quite a bit about topical versus oral NSAIDs, and this is out of ARC, looking at whether topical should be used or oral NSAIDs should be used. And basically, you're trading side effects and complications, oral versus topical. So with topical, the biggest issue is skin sensitivities and reactions of the skin, whereas with oral NSAIDs, obviously, we've got more systemic impacts. I just saw this in Epic, I think, last week. And, you know, we talk about physician burnout and autonomy and all this kind of stuff. Epic actually gave me a hard stop when I tried to prescribe an NSAID to my patient. And these are the things I have to pay attention to if I was going to prescribe an NSAID. This kind of blew me away. I didn't realize I was supposed to worry about pregnancy in my 80-year-old. But apparently, I am. So this is the kind of stuff that we now have to worry about when it came to NSAID. You know, when I was in training, when I was a medical student, I mean, we prescribed this stuff like it was candy. And these are some of the issues that we're starting to think about and how technology is starting to impact our lives. So I certainly wasn't checking any of this until Epic forced me to check it last week. So this is something to think about as we start going down the road. When we look at the different treatment options that are out there for oral management, it's obviously really, really hard to understand what the options are. So this was a nice meta-analysis looking at all the different NSAIDs that are on the market, including Tylenol. And what they found was of all the NSAIDs that are out there, diclofenac performed the best. And believe it or not, they did not recommend paracetamol or Tylenol for the management of knee OA. So I thought that was a little interesting. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. I threw this up here. I mean, you have to be living under a rock if you don't understand what's going on with opiates. But this was an interesting study, and I just pulled this out basically in the context of knee OA, and I bet a lot of people don't realize this. This was a study looking at total knee replacements, and they examined how many patients were still on opiates coming out of their total knee replacement. So they looked at all their patients that were opiate naive going into their total knee replacement. 10% of the patients were still on chronic opiates 15 months after their total knee. Okay, opiate naive going into surgery. How many total knees are we doing a year, right? We're pushing a million, right? 10% were still taking narcotics 15 months after their surgery, okay? This is another paper that recently came out looking at our discharge prescription of opiates coming out of a total knee replacement. So my residents, obviously, I should be, but they're prescribing a lot of the prescriptions at discharge. So what they found was a direct correlation, one-to-one correlation, in the risk of dependence and addiction based on the size of that opiate prescription at the time of discharge from the hospital. Okay? So there's a direct correlation. Even one opiate coming out of the hospital has a risk of addiction and dependence. Okay? So in the context of opiates, not just management of NeoA, but its downstream impact in the management of our surgical patients as well, it's a pretty big deal. So steroid injections, you heard a little bit from Dr. Spitzer about steroid injections. They're meant for moderate to severe OA. The more crystalline the steroid injection is, the longer the residence time, the longer it's going to stay in the knee. About 3 to 4 injections a year on average is what most orthopedic surgeons have been recommending. So we did a survey in Louisiana, and I was curious. I came out of fellowship, and you know, when I was in residency and fellowship, we just gave steroid injections. And when I got into practice, one of the residents asked me, why are you giving this cocktail? I said, I don't know. That's what I saw in fellowship. That was the last thing I learned. So I wanted to figure out what exactly everyone's doing. So we did a survey of all the orthopedic surgeons and the rheumatologists within Louisiana just to get my hands around all the different steroids that were out there and what everybody was doing. And it was interesting. So the most common steroid that everyone was injecting was triamcinolone. The most common analgesic that everybody was putting in was lidocaine. Now remember, no one injects steroids on its own, right? We all have our cocktail. Probably every surgeon in here has a different cocktail. The interesting thing that I found was when we compared the rheumatologists to the orthopedic surgeons, orthopedic surgeons were injecting 5 cc's of stuff, so usually one cc of steroid, 5 cc's of the analgesic. The rheumatologists were injecting 2 cc's, so 1 and 1. So I thought that was a little bit interesting. But what we found was 22 different steroid cocktails between all the orthopedic surgeons and rheumatologists that are out there. So no consensus. So I thought this was interesting that when we talk about steroids, it's rarely steroids as simple as that, right? It's all the cocktails and it's everything that we all put in it, and it's all hocus pocus. We just use whatever that we saw, and very little science with that. So you just saw from Dr. Spitzer, one of the biggest issues I think we have in terms of steroid injections is the transient hyperglycemia that we see, especially in our diabetic patients. I mean, I've had patients come back to, a week later after I gave them a steroid injection, and when I was younger, I just give it, I had no clue. I give the injection. I had patients coming back with a blood glucose of 300, 400 a week after their standard steroid injection. I mean, it was pretty, and then, of course, they're calling my office after the injection, asking me what to do. I'm like, I have no clue. Call your primary care doctor. And the primary care doctor's yelling at me, telling them, why are you calling me? So we went into this kind of circular loop. Everyone's getting frustrated. So I think this is probably one of the big roles that we have, some of these new innovative treatments that are coming out, like the long-acting triamcinolone. One of the big controversies in terms of managing pain around NeoA going into surgery is the risk of infection if you have steroid injections too close to surgery. So there's a number of papers that have come out. This is one of the most recent ones looking at the risk of infection if you give steroid injections too close to surgery. So this is something to think about as we're trying to manage our patient's symptoms going into surgery. Some surgeons may be booking their patient 3, 4, 6 months out. So what do we do with that patient in that intervening time? And so we have solutions potentially for that. This is another study looking at ketorolac or Toradol as an intra-articular injection and the efficacy compared to steroids. This may be a potential solution in the short term while patients are waiting for surgery. We know steroids have a higher risk of infection. There's really no doubt in terms of infection in ketorolac in terms of intra-articular injection. But there may be an opportunity for using this. I use this routinely as well. It doesn't work as long and is not as effective, but it may be a potential opportunity to help with their pain management in the perioperative time frame. So one of the big issues we have in managing NeoA is how do we figure out what the right treatment is, right? There's so many treatments that are out there. And it'd be virtually impossible to do the perfect randomized control trial, to take all 15 options and randomize patients and have them use it for 5 years and then follow them out. So if we can't do that, then what's the next best way to figure this out? So it's this concept of a network meta-analysis. So we're going to take this big data analysis like you see at Google and Facebook, and we're going to apply those concepts to research. And so how do we figure this out using some of these kind of higher level analytic concepts? That's the idea behind a network meta-analysis. So what they do is they take randomized control trials, they look at all the different treatment arms within that randomized control trial, and then what we're going to try to figure out and impute is what happens between two treatments if there's not a direct trial. So for example, what is the difference, or how does naproxen behave to ibuprofen compared to celecoxib and ibuprofen? You can see there's no direct comparison. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the data that we got from celecoxib compared to these others, naproxen compared to these others, and then we're going to try to figure out how those two stack up against naproxen. Or ibuprofen, sorry. And what did they find? What they found was, generally speaking, the injections did better than the pills. And of the pills, diclofenac did the best. Now, here's something interesting. Tylenol and IV intra-articular placebo. Tylenol did not do as well as placebo. Okay? Tylenol did not do as well as placebo. So I don't get that. I take Tylenol. I think it works. I'm not crazy. Probably everybody here has taken Tylenol. It probably works for you. don't think anyone in this room is nuts. So what's going on with this paper? And actually, this made the NBC Nightly News. Tylenol doesn't work for arthritis. So what's going on with this? So this is a knee scope I did. So this is a meniscus tear, let's say middle-aged person. I put the camera into the knee right above the patella, right in that little pouch. And this is what it looked like, red, beefy, inflamed, looks pretty painful, right? I did what I did, treated the meniscus or plica or whatever it was. I came back to that same spot about 5-10 minutes later, and this is what it looked like. What's the difference? I didn't touch it. I didn't shave it. I didn't put a probe on it. I didn't do anything. What happened? So the time frame, those 5 minutes, what was going on? I was just flushing saline through the knee, right? Just the knee scope. What's that? No. So what did I do? I just flushed saline through the knee, right? So what happened here is basically intra-articular placebo. I just injected saline into the knee, right? But I flushed it obviously quite a bit. So that's what's going on here. Right, so we have an active control. And that's why we see intra-articular placebo, truly not a placebo in the sense of a sugar pill, that's actually doing something. So if we take that data then, and then go back and look at our research, what happens at some of the tried and true treatments that we've been used to doing, and we account for the fact that intra-articular placebo is truly not a placebo, it's an active control. Well, look what happens to the data. All of a sudden now, some of these things that we didn't think were important, all of a sudden shift to the left, right? So next time you guys read research and you look at intra-articular placebo and look at these other things, have the appropriate context so you understand what exactly is going on and how that data actually impacts the research. Steroids, again, still controversial. So this was a nice paper by Dr. Bhandari out of Canada looking at kind of the pros and cons for steroids and when to use them because they're such a common tool that we use in our daily lives. PRP is a huge, huge booming industry right now. A lot of people's talking about it. The challenge with that is the data and the research around these injections, especially in and around surgery, just management for chronic knee OA, is still up in the air. There's really not great evidence. Most of the guidelines and most of the societies still say that it's really not really supported by the research to consider PRP injections. So it's just too heterogeneous. We don't have a good handle on the role of PRP. Some other interesting treatments out of the pain management space. There's a lot of interest in targeting and burning some of the deep nerves, RF ablation of the deep nerves, either for chronic management of knee OA or going into a knee replacement. Some of the emerging data out of this is burning the nerves, deep nerves around the knee in the context of managing pain going into a knee replacement. Not that useful, not that beneficial. But there's still a lot of interest. It's getting pushed pretty hard by the pain management folks going after those deep geniculates with their RF ablation. And you heard from Dr. Spitzer some of the new stuff that's coming out, cryoneurolysis. So this is freezing of the sensory nerves around the knee. And so some nice data coming out. We've published on this, as have others, as an opportunity to control and mitigate pain chronically for knee OA and also in the context of prepping for surgery. So with that, I'll thank you for your time.